From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. So I'm doing a book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books that you've heard about on this show, you may go to my website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy of that book. If you are the first to ask, and you live in an area with domestic U.S. postal rates, and I still have the book, I will send it to you. I will pay the shipping. People seem confused on this count. You may ask for any book that you've heard of on the show, and if I still have it, and all those other qualifications are met, I will send it to you. Today on Write the Book, you will hear a conversation with the author T. Corragison Boyle, whose new novel, Outside Looking In, came out recently from Echo Books. The novel takes us back to the 1960s and to the early days of a drug whose effects have reverberated widely throughout our culture, LSD. In 1943, LSD is synthesized in Basel, Germany. Two decades later, a coterie of grad students at Harvard are gradually drawn into the inner circle of renowned psychologist and psychedelic drug enthusiast, Timothy Leary. Fitzhugh Loney, a psychology PhD student, and his wife Joni become entranced by the drug's possibilities such that their research becomes less a matter of clinical trials and academic papers and instead turns into a freewheeling exploration of mind expansion, group dynamics, and communal living. With his trademark humor and pathos, Boyle moves us through the Loney's initiation at one of Leary's parties to his notorious summer seminars in Zihuatanejo until the Loney's eventual expulsion from Harvard and their introduction to a communal arrangement of 30 devotees, students' wives, and children, living together in a 64-room mansion and devoting themselves to all kinds of experimentation and questioning. Is LSD a belief system? Does it allow you to see God? Can the Loney's marriage, or any marriage for that matter, survive the chaotic and sometimes orgiastic use of psychedelic drugs? Wry, witty, and wise, Outside Looking In is an ideal subject for T.C. Boyle, an American master, and highlights his acrobatic prose, detailed plots, and big ideas. It's an utterly engaging and occasionally trippy look at the nature of reality, identity, and consciousness, as well as our seemingly infinite capacities for creativity, reinvention, and self-discovery. T.C. Boyle has published 14 novels and 10 collections of short stories. He won the Penn Faulkner Award in 1988 for his novel World's End and the Prix Medici Etranger for The Tortilla Curtain in 1995, as well as the 2014 Henry David Thoreau Award for Excellence in Nature Writing. I apologize to anyone who speaks French. He is a distinguished professor of English at the University of Southern California and lives in Santa Barbara. When I spoke with him, I began by simply asking how he was doing. That wasn't actually my intended first question, but the answer led to a conversation on climate that I found really interesting, so I kept it. Speaking of climate, you may hear rain toward the end of our interview. There was lots of rain that day in Burlington, Vermont, which is where we are located, where I am located, and I was in a room with a skylight. It does not interfere with hearing the interview. It's actually rather lovely. But in any case, I hope you enjoy our conversation, which began, as I say, with my asking how T.C. Boyle was doing.
Yeah, just everything is just great.
Oh, good.
I don't know what your weather is like. I mean, I've been tweeting when the Europeans, they're having a heat wave, et cetera. Here we are after 6 years of drought. We had a rainy winter. And the last 2 weeks here on the coast, the sun has barely shone, which is just the way I love it. Mm. And in fact, even though it's almost the end of June, the last two nights I've had a fire going because it was, you know, like 59 degrees and the old house gets a little chilly.
Oh,
so this is pretty great.
Where do you live?
We live in Montecito, which is by Santa Barbara.
Okay. Yeah. The only time I've ever heard you speak was, I'm not even remembering, it might have been an AWP conference, and you were reading a story about the drought. You were reading a story about people siphoning each other's neighbors' hoses.
Yeah, I'm such a wise guy, by the way. I wrote that story like in the second or third year of the drought, you know.
Yeah.
preposterously and absurdly projecting into the future. Mm. Little did I realize that not only was it not so prophetic, but we wound up having 6 years of drought.
Yeah, my mother-in-law lives in Chico, and my sister-in-law lives in Redding, and they've had all these fires. It's just awful.
Yeah, last summer, the entire state was on fire at all time.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. So this is a miracle that, you know, we're getting the coastal influence, we had the rain. Of course, the fires will come, but each day that we don't have wind blowing and sunshine, to me, is a good one.
Yeah, well, congratulations. Enjoy it. All right, let's talk about Outside Looking In. I really enjoyed reading it. I just wanted to start out by asking, you know, why you wrote this book at this time, if it had to do, I mean, there is sort of a renaissance of LSD in the last few years, and I wondered if that was why, or if it had more to do with Leary, or what brought this to you?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, the fact that LSD has come out of the closet again. I did a talk for the New York Times with Michael Pollan and Eilert Waldman recently, who got onto this before me, actually. Michael wrote an article in the New Yorker, I think in 2015, which got my antennas up. But also, of course, I wrote Drop City about the high efflorescence of hippie times in 1969, which begins with an acid trip, and, you know, acid is the drug of that generation. So I was curious in a number of ways. I wanted to step back from that to before my time and find out how this all happened. So Leary's life was fascinating. You could write a 10,000-page novel about him, and there's no end of material. But that wasn't my interest. My interest was to write something a little more controlled rather than the, you know, over-the-top, look how clever I am kind of novels of the 60s. Been there, done that. And to see how this all evolved. Would we have had Jimi Hendrix with eyeballs on his jacket if it weren't for LSD? Which, by the way, is why the book begins with the set piece of Albert Hofmann synthesizing the drug and taking the first trip ever, you know, back in 1943.
And that's all well documented, right? I mean, like, that bicycle scene was actually a historical moment, correct?
Yes. So for those who don't know, Albert Hofmann was a chemist who worked for Sandoz Laboratories in Basel in Switzerland. And his job was to make new chemicals for sale. And he'd experimented with various ergot compounds to try to come up with a drug that would be more effective than the one SIBO was using to ease women's parturition and birth and so on. And he came up with many different drugs, and none of them seemed very effective in animal trials. But he had a hunch about this one batch. It's LSD-25, which is why we call it 25. He'd made all these other batches. And he synthesized it again. That was in 38 and 43. And, you know, he was very careful. He was a chemist, he was very precise. But he must have gotten some on his fingers because he experienced some hallucinations of a sort. And then he went back determinedly and took a dose, dosed himself to find out what would happen. And this is what we call Bicycle Day on April 16th. Mm-hmm. The only person who knew about this was his assistant, Susie Rammstein, who was a young woman, the only female assistant there, lab assistant, and she had to get him home to Böttingen, which is 10 clicks away, on his bicycle. And so, Bicycle Day, and I wrote it from her point of view, almost as a folktale. I've always loved this story and the true details of it because, it's like, I don't know, Washington Irving stories or something, you know, and it's a creation story. And I just had tremendous fun doing that. But then, of course, the rest of the book goes straight to Harvard and graduate students of Leary's and what their response is to this cult that he forms around him, because he believed, as he says, and as I quoted in the book, I learned more from one experience with psychedelics than I did in 15 years as a psychologist, and he really believed all this.
Yeah, yeah. There were two things about that early scene with Susie chasing Herr Hoffman. There were two things I loved. One was, and you do this in a lot of places in the book, I loved how beautiful you write the world sober. And that was one of, do you mind if I just read a paragraph from that scene?
Oh, please do.
Okay. So, this is after she leaves him. She found her bike propped against the tree where she'd left it. It was chilly now, but the crickets sang their night song, and the frogs, awakened after a long winter's sleep, joined in. She was out in the country on her own, and it must have been past 10 at night. Her mother would be furious. She swung a leg over the crossbar of her bike, pushed off, and began pedaling down the dark driveway to the darker road. And there was no moon in the sky to guide her, only the pale, distant luminescence of the stars God had put in the heavens to mark his boundaries. She's not done the drug. And you do this in a lot of places. You're just, and actually you sort of draw our attention to it. You know, there's this other one, I'm not going to read that whole paragraph, but there's another one where I believe it's Joni is noticing the beauty of a moment, and the paragraph ends, "the world as it is." You know, there, I think that you were just alerting us to the fact that what's happening with the drug is also happening all the time, in a way.
Yes. Okay, so if I look back over all my 28 books, or right back to the first one, Descent of Man, after the Charles Darwin title, I realized that what I've been writing about my entire life is our relationship to nature as animals on a mysterious planet, yeah, which has no purpose and no meaning and no God, except the gods that we invent. And what are we doing, and what does it mean? And so, yes, of course, there is this, our God is nature, and we are part of it, even though we try to deny that. And so, yeah, do we need a drug to illuminate that for us? Maybe so. But if we just are mindful and respect our inner selves and slow down the crazy pace of our mechanized electronic society, maybe we'll see something that we don't normally see. Yeah. So there is just the beauty, and I love the descriptions that you read. For me, as a literary writer, the essence of a good book for me is in the writing, the line-to-line writing itself, and the images that it creates in your head, which is why I've never been a fan, for instance, of any kind of genre writing. It doesn't do it for me. It may tell a great story, but, and that's the essence of all fiction, and it has to tell a great story, but the great writers, to my mind, create these images. And the line-to-line writing is like music. It's a beautiful kind of music. And when you just called, I was just working and finishing up for the day and playing music. I've never written anything without music playing, because there is a musicality to the language that I want to inhabit when I'm working.
Yeah. Will you find that a certain kind of music is not doing it for you today, and you're going to have to turn off the Beatles and turn on Stan Getz or whatever it is?
So, not necessarily. And you would think that when I'm writing a period piece, as I often do, I would listen to the music of that period, and I sometimes do. But essentially, in the early morning when I'm doing emails and tweets and business, I'm playing rock and roll, which is my love. As soon as work starts, I'm going to classical music and the jazz of my youth, like John Coltrane, Miles Davis, etc. I cannot listen to lyrics, obviously, when I'm writing words, but I do need the music behind me. It's soothing and it's inspiring, and it gives me a kind of rhythm. And of course, I'm not always aware of it, because, as you know, the beauty of writing, and on the other end, reading, is that it does take you out of your body altogether and out of your consciousness. And so there are long stretches in which I'm not actually hearing the music. But, you know, then I come to, and there it is, and it's beautiful. And then I go back and hope for another long stretch when I'm completely removed.
Yeah, that's
That's interesting. I've known people that have to have music on or that enjoy having music on. I absolutely can't have music on, which drives me. Yeah, I'd love to, but I don't seem to have that kind of brain. I don't know.
Well, I wouldn't want to make any criticisms of such people, but my wife is like that, too. I often say to her, well, she likes music, but she would never think of turning on music on her own when she's just hanging out. She prefers silence. Mm. I often say to her, well, babes, once I'm dead, you'll get plenty of silence around here.
Yeah. No, I will put on music when I'm hanging out, although there was a period of time when my children were little that, yeah, I stopped. It was just like, I just need quiet. When I can have quiet, I need quiet.
Okay, well, I, as you may know, I spend a lot of time in the Sierra Nevada. And I work, I rent a house and I work, and then I walk out in the woods after work. And that is absolute silence and the glory of nature, and I need that very deeply. Yeah. As much as I need to hear music, I also need to hear just the birds. I see people jogging, wearing their various music devices over their ears. I would never do that. Music has its time and place. But I want to hear the birds. I want to smell the breeze. I want to be part of nature when I have that opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of nature brings me back to that scene with Susie on the bike. And before we get past that, I do want to mention one other thing about that scene, which is you have actually two scenes in this book. And I wondered if the scene with Susie inspired the other one. You have two scenes in which I will call it sort of the uninitiated are literally chasing down their giants. And one is Susie biking after him. But then the other one you have later, your character Fitz, who's your sort of...
He's the protagonist, along with his wife, Joni.
Right. So, yeah. And he gets the first narrative point of view after Susie. And he's like running madly to keep up with Tim at one point, too. And I was like, oh, I wonder, is that just happened, or was that on purpose, that these two people are chasing down their heroes, basically?
Well, you may know that I've written a number of historical novels, and several of them are about gurus. So I've written about Dr. Kellogg, who invented the cornflake in The Road to Wellville, or Dr. Kinsey, who invented sex in The Inner Circle, or Frank Lloyd Wright in The Women. I'm very interested in people who say to you, in essence, come to me and give me everything you have, be my follower, and I will absolve all your sins and troubles and problems. I always find that odd from the point of view of the followers. And so I keep playing that scenario over and over again. So yes, of course. Of course, I think, your interpretation seems to square with what I'm hoping for.
Right, yeah. And I think even though it's fictional, you also in Drop City have that kind of dynamic with the leader of the cult. And
yes, Norm Sender.
Right.
Who deserts them in the end.
Yeah.
Takes them all to Alaska and it's wintertime and he just leaves them there.
That book was so awesome. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm going to talk about Drop City a little later. I wanted to ask you about research. Now, I feel like a book like this, there's so much that you probably want to get right about the science and the history, biography. But I think sometimes research can be very seductive, and it can be hard to know how much is too much detail to include on that level. So I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Exactly. So I, as a young writer, had the opportunity to a couple of times be on stage with E.L. Doctorow, whom I really like and admire. And one night, I think it was for the Paris Review, we were doing something, and somebody asked him about that. He only wrote historical novels, and he said this. He said, there are a lot of writers who never get their books written get seduced by the research itself. Now, I love the research. I love the history I'm giving you, which is why I don't distort it, really. I really want to turn you on to the history, like we were just talking about, Bicycle Day. On the other hand, as Dr. O said, I believed firmly that you have to realize that you're an artist, not a historian, and you're doing this in order to create a work of art that will reflect on the history and try to discover what it means to us today. So typically I would do maybe 3 months of research. If I have to go see someplace like Millbrook, well, then I'll go there, you know, or the University of Indiana, where Kinsey was. But essentially, I'm just reading and taking notes. And so the psychedelic literature is enormous. You could fill an entire city with it. So I read some Leary biographies. I read about Leary and his students, and about the drugs themselves, and about Hoffman and Hoffman's own book, LSD, My Problem Child. And at a certain point, I felt that I knew enough to get going, and I got going. And I never know where any book or story is going to go. I have a kind of idea, and I follow it. And each day that may change, and it may move forward, it may move backwards, but I just follow it, which is why, by the way, I only am interested in writing fiction and nothing else, because it's a process of discovery that amazes me to get to the end of it and find out what I may have discovered.
Right. Right, and the aspects of this book that are historical and not fictional are not your narrative points of view. The title "Outside Looking In," I think it refers to the LSD experience, but it's also got an interesting mirror of your characters who are narrating are looking into what you'll call the inner circle. You know, like it's you don't have Leary narrating, for example. So that's got to be really fun to be able to create the people that were around him.
Exactly, and again, I've used this sort of point of view in other books, although, for instance, The Inner Circle is a first-person narration and a single point of view throughout. Nonetheless, the narrators are in thrall to a guru of one sort or another and totally dedicated to him, and we don't see what these gurus are thinking. We only see them in action as viewed by their acolytes.
Mm-hmm. You don't write a lot of first-person narrative, do you?
I do.
Oh, do?
For novels, I was just quoting from a friend of the Earth today, by the way, because all the Europeans are complaining about their it's 98 degrees in Berlin or something. And I want to remind them that I wrote about global warming back in 2000.
Yeah.
That shifts narration from first to third and first to third and back again.
Okay.
Budding Prospects is in first person. Many, many of the short stories are in first person. And that may be because, you know, I get locked into these larger narratives in third person. And when the stories come around, maybe I just want to break out with them.
Yeah.
So that some of the stories in the Relive box are probably half of them are in first person. Okay. And so too with the new stories I've just written. You saw maybe I Walked Between the Raindrops and the New Yorker last summer. And and others I've been writing lately. Or the one that was at Esquire in March, What's Love Got to Do With It, which is narrated from the point of view of a middle-aged woman in the first person.
Okay.
And by the way, that's a story that I'm dying to perform live, but it would be odd since it's a woman speaking and I'm not a woman. And now I suppose I could do it in drag or just ignore it.
Yeah, you have to be so careful these days, too, don't you? Like, actually, that was a question I had for you later.
I don't know if I have to be careful because I don't care about the nunnery of the politically correct.
Oh.
I am just going to do what I'm going to do. I mean, it's odd to be the character. I love to perform on stage, and I almost always do an I narrative because in one sense or another, I am that character. I can be that character. I can act that character.
Yeah.
It would be difficult, though, to convince a live audience if I am a woman, if I'm talking from the point of view of a woman, because they can see me, and clearly I'm not a woman. Now, that wouldn't make a difference in a third-person narration in the slightest bit. But in a dramatic presentation on stage with the live audience, I think, for me anyway, it would be a little sketchy. And yet I love the story, and I would love to present it.
Oh, you should try it. And the other thing is, if you love doing the performance, you'd probably do it well.
Oh, I hope so. You know, eventually I do the books on tape, so eventually when that collection is done, I will read her in the first person.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Dickens used to perform his work, and I think actually he did it so sort of physically that it was one of the things that caused his demise, I think, in the end.
He worked hard. He worked real hard. And of course, I'm tremendously jealous of him because we writers are marginalized these days. Because of the march of technology. In his day, he was the Rolling Stones, he was the cinema, he was everything, all wrapped in one, and he was a great ham. And I'm a great ham, too, and for my audiences, I love to turn them on, especially audiences that might not remember that the reason we love literature is because we first heard it read to us aloud by our parents when we were children, and that voice is always there for us.
Yeah. I'm curious if you ever met Timothy Leary.
No, I've never met him. No. And in fact, my era is more of what I wrote about in Drop City, the late 60s. And by then, of course, we had done all the drugs, and we knew far more than anybody. We were just completely supreme. How could anybody know anything more than we do? And, you know, he was, to us, this ridiculous clown in a robe muttering on TV, an obvious acid burnout. And I didn't really have any respect for or interest in him until I began to do the research and saw him as he was in the beginning, when he was this charismatic, young psychologist who is taking the world by storm, until he fell off the boat, really. And this is what I love about this material as well. How did we get to Drop City? How did we get to communes and all of this? Well, Leary, on the East Coast, was one of the first to do this.
Yeah.
They came together with this sacrament of LSD, and they had a secret society, and they got the house at Millbrook from one of his acolytes, this big mansion that they had to live in for $1 a year, and further their experiments, which were really sexual and group living experiments, as well as the drug experiments. And of course, there were hangers-on and people driving up from the city and parties and so on. And it gave rise to what was to happen in the next several years with the whole acid revolution and the hippies and communal living and all the rest.
Yeah. No, there was a lot of, I remembered a lot from Drop City as I was reading this book, and it did feel like it was sort of the precursor to that whole revolution or that whole period.
Well, thank you. I have to say that I love you dearly, because you are the kind of reader that we all hope for, who knows that, you know, this is not just a single isolated book that I've thrown out there. This is part of a long continuum of books, which I hope, in some sense, speak to one another.
Yeah.
Over the course of many, many years.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the imprinting thing. So he was really big on this philosophy that his students, they started out as students at Harvard, would do the drug that he called the sacrament, the LSD-25, and then that he, as their sort of like overseer and guide through their journey, they would imprint on him.
Well, as in the book, he's referencing Konrad Lorenz, the Austrian psychologist who quite famously coined this term of imprinting. He raised geese,
right.
If without the mother present. The first thing the geese saw when they hatched was Konrad Lorenz, and so they imprinted on him as if he were the mother. So that is the science behind it and the metaphor that Leary used. But I don't know if he felt it as nakedly as the way you've just described it, I mean, all that is hidden in one's psyche, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure that he reveled in his later incarnation as the guru of LSD and psychedelics in general. But at the time, yeah, of course. I mean, but don't the students imprint on great professors anyway, with or without the drug?
Right.
He just felt that the drug was a shortcut to that kind of imprinting. I should say, too, that all of my drug experiences happened in my late teens, early 20s, when I was living in New York and disordered and crazy and not knowing what I wanted to do in life. By the age of 25, I had grown up to a degree and I discovered what I wanted to do passionately, which was to write. And I turned my back on that and went to the Iron Writers Workshop, which kind of saved my life. In any case, I'd done all of that. Not that I'm an angel and stopped that day, but I had some wariness and I knew burnouts and I knew, you know, dependency on drugs and so on. And my professors, particularly my mentor, my PhD mentor, Frederick P.W. McDowell, who is a professor of English specializing in 19th century British, which is what I specialized in because of him. He wanted me to love literature in the way he did and to grow as a scholar and a writer, period. What if I had been a student in psychology of Leary's in 1962? What would he want me to do? Well, he would want me to grow and expand in that way, yes, but absolutely, 100%, I would have had to do the drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, I so felt for, his students, I guess, but you create these characters that are specific individuals in this book, and Fitz and Joni are the main characters that we interact with. Fitz is one of his students. Joni is Fitz's wife. And, you know, I just, like, these students were just, you know, and once Harvard dropped Leary, these students must have just been completely lost, like with their plans and with their ideas about what they wanted to do. And it was very sad, really.
Well, they were, because they were in the forefront of this dynamic thing that had happened to psychology, and they were the chosen. But then Harvard kind of shut the door on that because of the scandals and the fact that students were pretty much required to use a drug in order to proceed in a program. So it's all dramatized in the book, of course.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I feel bad for them, too. I've heard peripherally from two people who were there at the time who have read the book and felt that I was capturing the essence of it, which, you know, makes me feel great, because I wouldn't want to offend them or to get it wrong. I'm just taking an imaginative journey regarding what I've read and understood about the period.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Fitz and Joni, and I liked the way that you set up their entrance into this world. Fitz is looking pretty much for normalcy. I mean, he wants to get his degree, he wants to become a professor, he wants to be able to afford to provide for his family. And then Joni is just incredibly intelligent and underutilized person who's bored. And I feel like in each in their own way, they are so ready for something to happen, and poised to take part in this whole experiment for their own reasons. I just wonder if you want to take a couple minutes to talk about developing these characters.
Well, again, this is coming out of the whole mentality of the 1950s, and the wife as a homebody and, you know, supporting her husband, which is what happened with Joni. She had gotten pregnant as an undergrad and had to drop out and serve the needs of her husband and son. And finally, when Fitz, who had been working as a high school psychologist, climbed up the ladder and was able to get accepted at Harvard, she went with him, you know, as his helpmeet, as in the way that it was in that period. But I was hoping that readers would see that she develops into something much more than that as we progress through this cult that they've found themselves joining.
Yeah, although her participation becomes sort of obsessive at a certain point, which was interesting to me. I don't know.
I believe that they all became obsessed.
Did they?
Because, you know, again, with these gurus that we're talking about, it's a kind of religion. You know, people who are religious fanatics are very boring to talk to because they have one subject only. They believe in it totally, but there's also a little glimmer of unbelief, and they must keep that at a distance. They have to talk to convince themselves, because if any dose of unbelief or reality should come into their worldview, then they are bereft. Everything collapses. It's a regimentation. It's a way of insulating yourself from the world with a firm belief in something, whether that's a religious doctrine or, in this case, the doctrine of mind expansion. It gives you a purpose in life. And, of course, as we all know, there is no purpose to life except to create more life. That's what happens here on this planet. And no matter what we do, it is heartbreaking and purposeless. So people need something to hold on to.
Right. Well, I want to talk again about Drop City. You do something in this book that it's sort of how I first found your work, actually. I was working on something of my own, and I wanted to change settings in a very big way. Like, I was going from Vermont to Spain in 1969. And so I put a thing out to my writing friends saying, what books do a really good job of changing setting? And so I was told to look at Drop City by a friend. And you do it in this book, too. You take them from Cambridge in the late 50s, early 60s, and then they go to Mexico. I mean, these are big setting changes, and yet I don't find it at all of a bump out. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about changing setting in a novel in a way that is, you know, kind of organic and feels right.
Oh, shucks, Sheila. I mean, I'm just doing what comes natural. It served my purposes to follow the true history of the cult, which went to Zihuatanejo. I've been to Zihuatanejo. I have a general recollection of it. I studied the texts about it. I moved them there as efficiently as I could. I think one of the problems with any fiction or film is in putting you into the scene without over-describing or giving too much information. There's a kind of point at which there is just the perfect balance of information, especially when you're talking of characters' point of view. You can't just stop and explain the facts and set it up. It has to happen organically through the point of view of characters who already know some of this stuff, so they can't be repeating it to themselves. It would seem very artificial.
Right.
So I don't know. It just, it's something you develop over the course of 28 books, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Do you enjoy switching setting? Like, do you feel like, okay, cool, now I'm going to go to Mexico? Or is it...
Yes, I guess so, but... Each story has its own demands and its physical setting, and I just follow it. In addition to the novels, I've written zillions of stories, and they can be set anywhere, at any time in history. So it feels very natural to me. I think I've, luckily from my point of view, I've always been a writer who could write on anything, anywhere, I hope, because that keeps me from being squeezed into a box imaginatively.
Do you tend to just work on one thing at a time, though, or do you work on stories?
Yes, strictly and rigidly, one thing at a time.
Okay.
And the reason being, I'm afraid that I would never finish if I got distracted by another. And a lot of writers, who, of course, are all now wrapped in chains in the sub-basement of the mental hospital, they operate in the opposite way. They hit the wall with one thing, and they turn to the next thing, and back and forth. I think this is the way of mental illness and suicide. I think for me, no matter how difficult it is, I stick with it. And an example is my book, San Miguel, about the island off the coast here of Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. While writing When the Killing's Done about Santa Cruz Island, I discovered these two stories set on San Miguel in different historical periods, both from this, one from a memoir and one a fragmentary diary of women who lived there, one in the 1880s and the other in the 1930s. Alone, I mean, just with their family. They were the only people on the whole island. And the correspondences were great, and I wanted to write about that. And I just felt I'd like to respect or recapitulate the kind of point of view and tone that they were setting for me. And so I set myself the task of writing an historical novel from the point of view of three women that has no irony. So this is my middle name, Irony.
Yeah. You know?
And could I do it? I got about, I don't know, 60 pages in and damn near gave up. But I kept banging my head against the wall and found a way back into it. And it clicked and it worked. And I'm very pleased and proud because it's something totally different. Now, I'd written stories like this, but I'd never written a full-length narrative. Again, I think you have to challenge yourself. Otherwise, you'll write the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. So that actually brings me to my next question pretty well. I'm going to, if I may, read a quote from an essay you wrote called This Monkey, My Back. Mm-hmm. You say, I can see how my books and stories are tied inextricably, how the themes and obsessions, the search for the father, racism, class and community, predetermination versus free will, cultural imperialism, sexual war and sexual truce, keep repeating. I can see this, but only in retrospect. And it made me wonder if you ever avoid an obsession when you see it starting to form in a, like, okay, this book's not about dad, so I just have to stop that. Do you ever do that, or?
Well, the only breaks that I've put on are when I have a great idea for a story, and after I think for about three beats, I realize I've already written it. aside from that, no, I think all of us are working out our obsessions. We don't even fully know what they are or what our themes are. That's why we make art. We want to find out.
Okay. Now, I think early on you used to publish under T. Karagas and Boyle.
I still do.
Oh, you do?
Just open the New Yorker. There it is.
So that's what, is that your story name now, or?
Well, no, that's my real name, and that's what I use in all my books. But, God, it's a quarter century ago or more, my British publisher decided to edit my name, and for this reason, it fits bigger on the cover. And I said, okay. And it makes it easier for everybody. And so here I am, TC.
Okay. So, but do some of your books still have the full middle spelled out or not?
All the books do.
Oh.
Inside the cover.
Oh, I see. Okay. I was just curious about that one.
But, you know, more to the point is, what will it read on the gravestone, T.C. or T. Karagason? Or maybe we could have T. Karagason and then in parentheses, T.C. What do you think?
Well, why not Tom? Like, what's wrong with Tom?
But Tom is too ordinary.
Oh, okay.
That's what my wife calls me, though.
Let's see. I was going to ask if you've read any other authors' books lately that you would recommend to listeners.
I have. Right now I'm reading, you're in Vermont, huh?
I am.
I'm reading Rick Atkinson's new one about the Revolutionary War,
Which
is quite wonderful. He's great with the details of the odd things that we don't know about. It's pretty wonderful. I've been reading a lot about animal consciousness lately, like Franz Duval's new book, for instance, which, by the way, is what I'm writing about. Next, Carl Safina's Beyond Words is brilliant along these lines and heartbreaking. Wow, all sorts of stuff.
Okay. Well, that's great. Those are a few good titles.
Yeah, I don't read novels a lot when I'm writing a novel because I don't want somebody else's voice to interfere. When I'm writing stories, it doesn't really matter. But over the long haul with a novel, it's kind of tough. But I do still read some novels while writing.
Okay.
And I have done so recently. Not so much as I would if I weren't writing a novel myself.
All right. So in just about every book, I always feel like you really nail what I would call the voice of the piece. And I think, too, that's sort of like intertwined with your own voice as an author. You know, your voice is, calm and even and sort of alternately humorous and smart. And so I just wondered if you have advice for writers about finding maybe the voice of a piece, because our authorial voice develops over a career, I think, but finding the voice of a piece?
I say let it fly. And the voice, again, whether it's going to be an I narrative or a third-person narrative, should be determined by the material itself. Whatever sparks you when the first line occurs to you, just ride with it. I mean, I don't worry about it much. Every once in a while, I'd say, instead of every 30 stories, I would write a page and a half in third person and then change it to first or vice versa, but that's rare. It almost always just comes to me in a form, and I follow that form. I don't think it has to be that complicated. My style lately is very intimate. That is, it's a very close third-person point of view, or, of course, when I'm doing first-person, first-person. So that I'm trying to replicate the way the character thinks in a third-person narrative, but also you have to stand back a bit to make the narrative connections. Sometimes I would like to be a little more distant, like in early books like World's End, for instance, or Water Music, in which there's more of a traditional overview, like in a 19th century novel. And maybe I would like to come back to that in a novel before long. But right now, the one I'm writing is like what you've just read in its method. That is, I am inhabiting the points of view of the characters as they see the world. Mm-hmm. So it's a trick. I mean, you have to write with this beautiful language. Like, for instance, I hope I'm not pumping myself up too much. I mean, the quote that you read earlier.
Yeah.
It has to be beautiful. It has to be shapely and so on. And yet it's still coming from the character's point of view, and that it can limit you to a degree because you can't make the leap into hyperspace of the, overseeing consciousness.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it's very intimate because you're inside their brain in hearing the way they speak and think the words themselves.
Right. Yeah. In this book, Outside Looking In, there's a scene where Fitz is driving, and you write something about a fat man who suddenly flung open the door of a parked sedan and set one fat foot out on the pavement. And I remember reading that and thinking, if it were Joni's point of view, she would be noticing something else. Like, she would be noticing the cut of his suit, or what exactly was the sedan, or something. You know, it's like it really is very intimate, you know, what they each choose to see.
Right, or she wouldn't have noticed that at all, probably.
Maybe, yeah. So I just want to mention again, the name of the book is Outside Looking In. It's a novel published by Echo and written by T.C. Boyle. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me. This was really fun.
My pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with the author T. Kerragason Boyle. You can learn more about his work at tcboyle.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, T.C. Boyle. Sometimes he finds his stories through reading the newspaper. He'll see a newspaper clip about something interesting, but because news stories are journalism, he says, we don't know the why or the how of these stories, just the what. Sometimes with students, he'll suggest finding a one-paragraph story in the newspaper and trying to inhabit it to find out the why and the how. He jokes, man bites off own nose, swallows it, winds up in the hospital. What's that about? Write about it. He also suggests, as ever, reading the work of great writers. This helps us see ways into ideas that we may have had on our own. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Thanks to my show, I have a lot of books, and so I'm going to repeat here. I love books, but they're starting to take up more space than I have. So as I said earlier, I am doing a book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books that you've heard about on this show, you may go to my website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy. If you're the first to ask and you live in an area with domestic U.S. postal rates, and if I still have the book, I will send it to you. I will pay the shipping. You may ask for a recent book or an older one, whatever. If I don't have it, obviously I can't send it to you, but I would love to share any that I have with other readers. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available at writethebook.podbean.com and also at other podcast sites like iTunes and Spotify. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And then, as always, if you like the show, please do rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all of your friends. Share the show. That would be wonderful. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.